not going to dismiss you right now, kids, for children's church. We're going to have bell choir practice. So everybody that's involved in the bell choir after the special, you can leave and go. So even if you're a little bit older than 8 years old, well, not old. Y'all know what I mean. But anybody wants to participate in the kids' bell choir, you can be dismissed as soon as the special music is over. All right, I said it.
For a year, Shirley and I have been talking about playing Jesu, Joy, and Man's Desire. One of Bach's great pieces from his cantata. He wrote like a million cantatas, and he would take one song, and he would set it about 10 different ways. And every one of them told me that the mind of God was great with him. And he signed all of his work, Soli Deo Gloria. Is it a? No. And he said that the purpose of music is to honor God and enlighten our neighbor. And you think about that. His music is so profound that it should just light up your mind with the reality of God, with the character of God. Jesu, just think about this title, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desire. Think about that title. Wow. And the song is both very joyful, but you also hear this dignity to it. It's like God is walking in our midst, throwing flowers and saying, yep, it's me.
Sharing with us, for putting the effort and the work, and for the beauty that's there. That's wonderful. Thank you. All right, children to Children's Church. And the children's church people told me that they're going to give them a lot of candy. So that parents, when you come to pick them up, no, they didn't say that. But this is the time of the year when that does happen a whole lot, right? Isn't it? Well, thank you for being here this morning. It's good to see you here. We're in the book of Jeremiah. I want to start off with this. The word is shame. And in human experience, shame can be as simple as a pimple on your face. Or it can be as complicated, as complex, as far-reaching as a big red letter A stitched on your clothing. Whichever way you go, it's definitely a human thing, a part of human experience from, well, since humans have been human, shame. Some hide from it, as did our very own parents, those who started this whole thing, Adam and Eve. Some drown it, self-medicate it. Some even end it all to find resolution to shame. It's the topic of many epic stories, from popular tales to great literature. In fact, this weight of guilt that we carry, we have become experts at trying to deal with. For instance, here we got Iron Man, all right? Let's put up the screen here, Iron Man. Iron Man, Tony Stark, billionaire, handsome, beautiful woman magnet, weapons expert, intellectual giant, swagger and power. The complete package. He had it all. But life changed when he came face to face with his guilt and the suffering that his life had caused. There in that cave with a pitiful captured Russian scientist, the very antithesis of the Tony Stark, a mirror was placed before him that showed him his guilt. And Tony was ashamed. And from that moment on, no more chasing money, power, women. It was replaced by his push to resolve his shame. And thus was born Iron Man. He faced his shame. In one way, it saved him. And in another way, it killed him. Shame. Well, let's go a little bit more literary here. George Bernard Shaw has been called one of the most important English playwrights after Shakespeare. In his play, Man and Superman, you didn't know that Bernard Shaw was the guy who did Superman. No, it's a very different man. There are two men who struggle for the affection of a woman. One is kind of a Tony Starkish guy. He's got it all, the looks and everything, but he's also very much a playboy. The other one is a very virtuous older man. And here, I'm going to give to you as a quote from that Tony Starkish guy who can't find anything to blame this other guy for except that he's a slave to shame. He says this, "We live in an atmosphere of shame. We're ashamed of everything that's real about us. Ashamed of ourselves. Ashamed of our relatives. Ashamed of our incomes. Ashamed of our accents. Of our opinion. Of our experience. Just as we're ashamed of our own naked skins. And it dogs us, even the most virtuous of us, shame. And it can destroy us." One more. In the book, The Little Prince, okay, the boy prince visits other planets in order to gain wisdom. In one planet, he finds a man who lives as a drunkard. And he asked this question, "Why are you drinking?" demanded the little prince. "So that I may forget," replied the tippler. "Forget what?" inquired the little prince, who was already sorry for him. "Forget that I'm ashamed," the tippler confessed, hanging his head. "Ashamed of what?" insisted the little prince, who wanted to help him. "Ashamed of drinking." That's us. Shame. For many, shame is simply a vestige of some lower life form we used to be, an aberration of DNA, or a bad or anomalous mutation. And though staunch materialists may discount it with a flick of the wrist, we've seen already that most of human expressions deal exquisitely with heroic efforts to deal with this shame, this guilt. And it also plays an important role in human society. We have systems of law that rely upon guilty in order to bring order and safety within our society. It's through that we enforce norms, acceptable and unacceptable behaviors. Those who don't have a sense of guilt or shame, who commit terrible atrocities, are aberrant. Criminals, sociopaths, psychopaths. Yeah, shame. Many of us come to church because of shame. Many of us don't ever come to church because of shame. I guess we should define these two words, because guilt and shame are kind of interchangeable here. So let's quickly do that. Guilt is a noun, and guilt is the fact of having committed a specified or implied offense or crime. You feel guilty when you believe you have committed an offense. Shame is something disappointing or not satisfactory. You feel shame when you believe you are a disappointment or not satisfactory. So guilt arises about what we do, whereas shame is who we believe we are. Guilt, do, shame, are. When I do wrong, I have guilt. And when I'm guilty, I'm ashamed. I feel shame. So what do we do with this? What has humanity done with this? What do we do with shame? Well, I went and looked, you know, on the net, Google, a couple of our celebrities. And I'm going to put it up here. A couple celebrities. But this is to help us get into what God has to say. Okay, Angelina Jolie, okay? She says this: "I don't believe in guilt. I believe in living on impulse as long as you never intentionally hurt another person. And don't judge people in your life. I think you should live absolutely free." Freedom, well, yeah, it's good. And she's right. But she's also right that you don't want to intentionally hurt others. And well, isn't that the role of guilt and shame? All right, another one. "If only I wasn't an atheist, I could get away with anything. You'd ask for forgiveness, and then you'd be forgiven. It sounds much better than having to live with guilt." And she would say the opposite of the other lady. "Don't let your passions lead you away from what you know is right." And she's right. We need boundaries. And so it's a conundrum. It's this conundrum. If you deny your shame, well, you live as a fool. And there's a lot of people who just don't think about right and wrong. And they're fools. We can't live that way. But if you admit your shame, well, then you become a prisoner. You're a prisoner. You can't really be yourself. You know? And so most of us try to live somewhere in between. We kind of choose our poison every now and then. What a terrible way to live. There is a better way. And you know where I'm going. We're going to the scriptures. God addresses shame and guilt head on because he's got a resolution for it. He doesn't back down in showing humanity their guilt and shame. And this is probably the main reason that we as humans find it very distasteful to read the Bible, because it's filled with accusations that serve only to add to our already overinflated sense of guilt and shame to the point of bursting. And like I said earlier, that's why a lot of people don't come to church, don't read the Bible, have nothing to do with religion, because it's all about shame. And in many ways, they're right. But God doesn't do that. He doesn't address our shame and guilt in order to condemn us, but to resolve it. And we're going to see this. The book of Jeremiah, chapter 24. If you'll turn there with me, chapter 24 in your Bibles, of the book of Jeremiah. And again, I want to thank you all for the privilege of being able to spend my time studying the Bible. I get paid for doing this. Isn't that awesome? So let's go together and see what God has to say, what he has to say to us. Chapter 24, and we'll just read the whole thing, all right? Chapter 24 of Jeremiah. After King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon exiled Jehoiachin, son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, to Babylon, along with the officials of Judah and all the craftsmen and artisans, the Lord gave me this vision. I saw two baskets of figs placed in front of the Lord's temple in Jerusalem. One basket was filled with fresh, ripe figs, while the other was filled with bad figs that were too rotten to eat. Then the Lord said to me, "What do you see, Jeremiah?" I replied, "Figs, some very good and some very bad, too rotten to eat." Then the Lord gave me this message. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The figs, the good figs, represent the exiles I sent from Judah to the land of the Babylonians. I will watch over and care for them, and I will bring them back here again. I will build them up and not tear them down. I will plant them and not uproot them. I will give them hearts that recognize me as the Lord. They will be my people, and I will be their God, for they will return to me wholeheartedly. But the bad figs, the Lord said, represent King Zedekiah of Judah, his officials, all the people left in Jerusalem, and those who live in Egypt. I will treat them like bad figs, too rotten to eat. I will make them an object of horror and a symbol of evil to every nation on earth. They will be disgraced and mocked and taunted and cursed wherever I scatter them. And I will send war, famine, and disease until they have vanished from the land of Israel, which I gave them and their ancestors. And so there's the passage. God shows Jeremiah this vision, this object lesson about figs. It's kind of a show and tell. And you got good figs and you got bad figs. Now, why figs? Well, probably because figs were common there, like, say, apples are common for us. In our day, we might not say it's a good fig or a bad fig. You're a good fig. You're a bad fig. No, we say, you're a good apple. Yeah, you're a bad apple, you know. And that's where the shame comes in. You don't want to be a bad apple. But here you have it. And so what's going on here that God calls people good or bad figs, you know, and the shame that comes with it? Well, quick context, okay, because we want to make sure we got this in context. You may remember that here the book of Jeremiah is Jeremiah's call to bring God's judgment, the message of judgment on the southern kingdom, Judah. Here's the reason why. They had abandoned God, as you may remember, and though God had given them all these good things, they continued to abandon him. God had rescued them from Egypt with personal displays of his power over evil. He had parted the waters for them. He had fed them with manna in the desert. He showed them his glory on Mount Sinai. He walked with them in the desert, a pillar of cloud in the day, pillar of fire by night. God was with them, and at the end, he gave them this land that he had promised to give them. So God was there, and he made himself pretty obvious to the people of Israel, but they decided no. He went as far as to make a covenant, an agreement with them. He pledged his love to them and asked that they pledge it back. And they did. But they broke the covenant. They disobeyed. Even though all the laws and regulations that he gave them were good stuff. They're like the secret of life. Look, just do this good stuff, which is good for you, and we'll be good. But they said no. And this is really the history of all people in general. I mean, we're all, in a sense, fig people. You know, we're apple people, fig people. And it also included the northern kingdom, which has already gone into exile. So everybody's fig. So this is the background, right? Fig people. So let's start with the bad news first, okay? Who are the bad fig? I mean, what's going on with the bad fig people? All people, all the Israelites, north and south, including us, fig people. Bad fig people start in verse 8. So let's go there to verse 8, if you would. See what the Lord says about these bad fig people. He says, "But the bad figs," the Lord said, "represent King Zedekiah of Judah, his officials, all the people left in Jerusalem, and those who live in Egypt." Well, bad figs, we put that up, is no bueno, right? In our picture here, it's the overripe figs. And overripe figs smell. They're sour. Figs give off this ethylene gas. And if you put overripe figs next to fruits or vegetables, they'll start to get them to get overripe very quickly. They're just not good. And it happens fairly quickly. And God says here that the bad fig people were the ones who were left behind. Left behind? Which sounds kind of wrong, right? I mean, the bad ones should be the ones that went into exile because they did bad stuff, you know. That's why they need to go into exile. But no, here it's the ones that were left behind that are the bad figs. And the good ones went into exile. So what's up with that? Well, it's not necessarily about exile because we've already seen that fig people are all the ones who pretty much have gone against God. So it has to do here more with submission and trust. Everybody's under judgment. But submission and trust. You know, some would be exiled, and those left behind would need to also submit to having been conquered. They would need to stay there and obey Nebuchadnezzar. The problem is that these bad fig people didn't do that. The ones that were left behind didn't submit. We know that right at the end of the exile, the siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, King Zedekiah attempted to escape with his army. He didn't submit. 2 Kings 25 tells us what happened. Okay. It says here, "Now in the ninth year of his reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his army against Jerusalem, and camped against it. He built siege walls all around it." They didn't have airplanes back then. They'd just bomb it and destroy it. They had to wait. So they built siege walls. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. On the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people in the land. Then the city was broken into, and all the men of war fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls that were beside the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were already in the city. And they went by the way of Arabah. Okay, so these are the king's and his army. "But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho. And all his army was scattered from him. And they captured the king, and they brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and he passed sentence on him. And they slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and then they put out his eyes and bound him in bronze shackles and brought him to Babylon. A bad fig. Didn't submit, tried to run away. Eesh. After this, those that were left behind, after Nebuchadnezzar went back to Babylon, back home, they wanted to escape to Egypt. Now, yes, getting out of the control of a despotic ruler is not bad. No, that's not the point. But God had told them, you are my people. This is meant for your discipline. Therefore, you need to submit and trust me. And if you go to chapter 42 of Jeremiah, you'll see that God said to them, stay here, do not go to Egypt. But they went to Egypt. They didn't trust God. They didn't submit. And that's why they were called bad fig people. Not because they were trying to escape from this exile and all this stuff. No, 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 that's not the point. The point is submit and trust. God has your back. Trust me. How about the good figs? All right, verse 4 through 7. 4 through 7, the good figs. Now, put up the picture again, and a good fig. I like figs. Anybody like figs? Oh, they're great, aren't they? Oof, they're like a bouquet to the palate. Sweet, with hints of honey and flower. Flowers, not the flower that you find. They're yummy. They really are. I could go on the trail, and on the trail, I don't know if you've seen it there is this one fig tree that's right on the trail. Oh, you've done it. Oh. And if you get it at the right time, before other people pick them, you can go up and they're good. They're really good. I like them. And so what made the good fig people, let's get back to this, what distinguished them from the bad fig people? Well, it's kind of weird again, and we're going to talk about this again. Verse 5, okay? Verse 5 says there, the good figs represent the exiles I sent from Judah to the land of the Babylonians. Okay, so the good fig people were the ones who went into exile. But exile is not good, which is true. But going into exile, and you know where I'm going here, is not some random thing. You see, this was part of God's plan, part of God's discipline to the people. He says, the exiles I sent from Judah to the land of the Babylonians. See, that's God's plan. And by going there, they're submitting to God's plan. And submitting to God is always a good thing. So we continue in verse 6. For I will set my eyes on them for good. I will bring them back to this land, and I will build them up and not overthrow them, and I will plant them and not uproot them. That's good stuff. It's God kind of good stuff. So the good figs submit to God by going into exile, and by submitting to God, he promises to do them good, which involves bringing them back, building them up, planting them, and not doing them bad. That's good stuff. But the really good stuff happens in verse 7. Verse 7 is the really good stuff. Okay, I'm going to put verse 7 up on the screen because this is what I think we've got to see, that this is God doing his awesomeness. Verse 7 says, I will give them a heart to know me, for I am the Lord. And they will be my people, and I will be their God, for they will return to me with their whole heart. Oh, that is awesomeness. Two amazing ideas that we need to extract by way of observation. One has to do with God's work, and one has to do with the people's obedience, God and the people. So let's look at the second one first. People and their obedience. The last phrase here puts it clearly. For they will return to me with their whole heart. They will return. Where did they go and where will they return to? Well, we know from what we read here that they went away from God. But you might say, Pastor, dude, if God is everywhere and we can't escape him, how does this work, you know? Well, it's the story of humanity. Adam and Eve, remember the story? They had all the trees in the garden, all of them. But God said, you can eat from all of them, just not that one. And that one introduced the possibility of not submitting, the possibility of not obeying. They could now choose to not obey, but they could also choose to obey. Right? Why did God do that? Well, I don't know for sure. But we see in the scriptures that there was a whole lot of love involved because of love. God loved them and wanted them to love him in return. He wanted a true relationship. And you can't love and be in a relationship if it's all pre-programmed. It just doesn't work. Love is a personal choice. And that's, I think, what the tree meant. You've got a choice. A true choice. If you're going to love me, here it is. For God, a huge risk. But it's a risk that God took on himself to give human beings the chance to love him, to really love him. In this book, the book of Jeremiah, the people of Judah have chosen to not love him, to disobey, to go against the covenant that he made with them. He said that he would care for them. He said that they would be his people, but they said, no, we don't want you. Instead of keeping the terms of the covenant, they turned away. Even though, as we said before, the terms of the covenant were good, man. It's the secret of life. So they were going to return to God. Okay, so return to God. The second thing we see here that is that a wholehearted return. Wholehearted. This is important. You see, wholehearted means that you're all in, that it's not halfway, that there are no gaps, there are no holes, there's no fudging, there's no mulliganing, none of that. Because when it comes to sin, well, how much sin is not good? For many, it's like, you know, the majority, you know. Like an election, you know. You just need to have a little bit more good in your life than bad. And then it just all balances out and you get to go to heaven because you have more good than bad. But tell me this. You who have been deeply hurt by somebody's wrongdoing, what kind of restitution would make it better? What I mean is this. The family of a murder victim, how do you fix that? How about a rape victim? He only did it once in his life. But what about the victim? How do you do that? The betrayal of adultery, how do you fix that? And it can even be just one word that wounds so deeply, but you can't take it back. How about that? We don't think of the effect. And that's why God says here, no, no fudging, no halfway, wholehearted. Wholehearted return. That's it. We can trust that God will look out for you. No, I don't want anyone to be hurt anywhere, at any time, at all. That's it. Return with your whole heart. He also says, return with your heart, okay? So, return, whole heart, and he also says, heart, you know? The heart, you know, when we speak of the heart, well, sometimes we speak about it as the seat of the emotions, but here in the scriptures, the heart really is the center of the person. It's the core of who you are. It's the essential you. It's the place where we decide, where we commit, where we gather our intellect, and emotions, and we put it all together, right there, it's the very essence of you, your heart. Now you might say, Pastor dude, a couple of weeks ago, when we were going through the book of Jeremiah, you told us that the heart is not good. It's a bad fig place, you know. It's not trustworthy. We're not to trust our hearts. And that's right. That's what God tells us. It's God who said that. Jeremiah 17:9, we'll put up on the screen here. And it says, the heart is more deceitful than all else and desperately sick. Who can understand it? And that expression puts us back into the conundrum. How can I or any human love God with a heart, the center of who I am, especially wholeheartedly, when I have a bad heart to begin with? How can you do that? And I think that's the point. It's critical to recognize this when we deal with the conundrum of shame. Let me illustrate this to you this way. Story. A camper had gone out on the lake. And out on the lake, the boat had tipped over and he fell into the water. Now, this camper didn't have his life vest on, and so he found himself in the water without a life vest and, as you may know, unable to swim. Okay? So there we are on the shore, not too far away, are all the adult counselors, you know, the camp counselors, and one of them is in charge of the swimmy thing because he's an expert swimmer. So the guy goes into the water, and they're all waiting on this, you know, the adults there are waiting on this expert swimmer expectantly. And the expert swimmer takes his shoes off, takes his shirt off, takes all his stuff off. But after all that, he just sits there. He doesn't dive in, watching. And the other people are looking at him. Dude, what are you doing, man? That guy's going to die. He needs to be rescued. He's drowning. And yes, the poor boy was in a desperate situation. As the seconds passed, his thrashing becomes less. And soon enough, there he goes, last time down. The adults are now panicking. Do something! He's going to die. Come on, do something. And after what seemed as a long wait, the expert swimmer jumps in, closes the gap between him and the boy in just a few strokes, reaches in, grabs the boy, and brings him back to shore. After pressing on the boy's diaphragm a bit and evacuating some of the water, he's back. He's okay. Yeah. He's a little bit scared, but he's all right. And so the adults look at him and say, dude, what took you so long? Why did you wait so long to go and rescue the boy? I mean, he could have died. Well, said the rescuer, I had to wait until he was truly in trouble, or else he would have tried to save himself and made it impossible for me to save him. That's the point. You see, knowing that our heart is deceitful, knowing that we can't deal with our own shame is critical, critical. And so now we can go back to the beginning of verse 7. This is what God does, and this is the awesomeness. Yes, he says here in verse 7 at the beginning, I will give them a heart to know me, for I am the Lord. You know, we read that God was going to do some things for them already. He was going to keep his eye on them for good. He was going to bring them back to the land. He was going to build them up, not overthrow them. He was plant them, not uproot them. He was going to do all this stuff. And we read that all this stuff is based upon what the humans were going to do, which was obedience from the heart, the whole heart, return, right? Those three things, return, whole, heart, you know. But we saw that this was impossible from back then, because our heart's no good. So what does God say? I'm going to give them a new heart. I'm going to give you a new heart. I will give them a heart to know me. Now you might say, Pastor, dude, this sounds like fudging. This sounds like meddling in the system. We've already seen that God is the one who's going to return them, you know, and all this obedience of heart. But no. He makes it obvious. They will return to me. They will be wholehearted. They will do it with their heart. In fact, that's the point. They, he says it twice, they and their. It's them. It's them. How is this possible? Well, how God actually works it, I don't know. But I do know this. God does it. And God does it because he wants to do it. He wants to make the bad figs into good figs. He offers to take the bad apples and make them into good apples. And I tell you what, I need that. Sign me up, Lord. I need that. I want to make sure that it's me who actually loves God. If I'm going to do this thing, I want it to be me. I don't want you to, no. If I know when there's fudging in the system, don't you think he knows when there's fudging in the system? Absolutely. He didn't fudge. How do we know that he never fudged? Right there. This is what Mike was singing about. This is what Ralph was singing about. This is what we're about. We're all ashamed in some way or other. And this is amazing. God wants to take that load of shame off of you and me. To really deal with it. That's the point. I'm going to give you a new heart. I'm going to do it. He's the only one that can do this. He's the only one that can give you a new heart without killing you. He can do that. You know, we've had to really work hard in the physical sense of, you know, my mom just went through open heart surgery, and we know about the heart, you know. At least we become more sensitized to it. But God's going to do this. You know, we no longer need to deny it, you know, like some people do, which subjects us to being foolish. We no longer just need to bear it all our life, and, well, we are prisoners of our own guilt and shame, you know. No. We don't have to do that anymore. God doesn't hide it. God doesn't deny it. He doesn't dismiss it. He doesn't fudge. In fact, God doesn't force it on you. Does he? No. He gives you a choice. He offers it. And then he seeks to persuade. That's what the whole book of Jeremiah is about. Look, follow me, please, please. Follow me, please. Look, if you will just return to me, I will take care of you. And he's been doing this in the Bible for these people for a long time. The whole this. And it all ends up with Jesus Christ. And he doesn't say, well, here, eat your Jesus Christ and cram it. No, he doesn't. He says, you have a choice. If you believe and trust in me, I will take care of your guilt and shame. I'll give you a new heart. We like new stuff. He defines it, of course, God defines it, but he also makes the way to resolve it. Isn't that awesome? Thank you, Lord. We all know about shame. We all do. We all come to church sometimes and we go, how you doing? Great. Couldn't be better. Inside, oh. Been a rough week. I did some things that if the pastor knew about, I wouldn't even come into church. They would kick me right out. Hey, we all deal with the shame. And I'm sad, you know, that so many times the church becomes a place where you got to clean yourself up before you come in. No. Jesus never said that. God never said that. He says, look, just come, submit, I will give you a new heart. No, you don't do that. All you got to do is come to me. I'm doing the thing. Just come. Just receive it. And this morning here, guys, you know, there may be somebody here who you've come a lot. You haven't received it. Maybe today is the day when you're saying, all right, God, I'm done. You've persuaded me. You've convinced me. I see it. And this life is filled. Churches are filled. You know, all whatever it is. Come to Him. Come to God. Come to Jesus. Let Him give you that new heart. That's the good stuff, man. That's the good stuff. Take God's offer. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for your word, Lord.